The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. And for the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from National Geographic, and if time permits, maybe an article from the Triangle Business Journal. Before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, I want to remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that will be featured in the articles that we'll be reading. Now, these are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. And today on Armchair Traveler, we're going to begin a series of articles about indigenous futures. Now, this is the title of the cover story for the July 2024 issue of National Geographic. As the cover caption states, from conservation to culture, how those who came first are charting a new tomorrow. National Geographic editor Nathan Lump is going to give us more insight from his monthly column. One of the things I love most about working at National Geographic is the continual learning. We spend our days looking into what is fueling new thinking in a wide variety of fields. It is our hope that by staying on the leading edge, we, in turn, will provide you with stories that provoke thought and advance your own knowledge. Globally, indigenous communities have always produced forward-looking models of innovation and sustainability, though these have often been overlooked. I became more acutely aware of this soon after I joined National Geographic in 2022. We already had plans to publish a story funded by the National Geographic Society and the Climate Pledge from photographer Kiliai Yuan about the promising ways indigenous peoples are leading conservation initiatives. But the more I immersed myself, and the more I came to understand that indigenous communities know, their creative thinking extends well beyond conservation into everything from language to film to fashion and art, and the idea for this special issue was born. You'll find three main types of features here, five stewardship stories anchored by Yuan's photographs showcase in different ways indigenous communities protecting and preserving their environment and traditions. Culture pieces bring to life how they are driving progress by leveraging intergenerational teachings as well as new technology and tools. And voices stories put indigenous creators and leaders front and center, examining how they and others are advancing our thinking. A note about the term indigenous: in the issue, we're using the simplest and broadest definition related to the original inhabitants of a certain geographic location. There are many things I'm proud of in this issue, but first among them is that nearly all of the content was produced by indigenous contributors, many of them working with us for the first time. We, like many publications, have an imperfect record of covering indigenous cultures and generally have done so from an outsider's view. Bringing more indigenous perspectives into National Geographic provides a new level of richness to the work, which we believe meaningfully deepens our collective knowledge and understanding. And he goes on to say, I hope you enjoy the issue. So there we begin, okay? So now, the special series, as we noted, includes five articles falling under the category of stewardship, eight articles that fall under the category of voices and culture, or eight more articles. And on today's program, we're going to read the first article from the stewardship group and one article from the voices and culture categories. Now, all these articles will be covered in future episodes of Armchair Traveler, so we'll continue this for a couple of months, I think. Our first article from the stewardship group is Defenders of the Reef. It's written by Gleb Rygordetsky. Now, photographs for several of the articles were done by renowned photographer Kiliai Yuan, a.k.a. Killy Fish, as he calls himself. In this article, we learned that the Hatohobe People's Initiative protections ensure an atoll's health for generations to come. On a clear morning in December, at the southwestern edge of Palau Archipelago, rangers from the Helen Reef Resource Management Program were starting their day, tidying up around their station and checking spear guns for afternoon fishing, when they heard a motor and soon spotted an unknown vessel. This could only mean trouble. They would have been notified about a legitimate craft coming to Hatashari, as Helen Reef is known to the Hatohobe people, the traditional stewards of the area. That boat was coming in with lots of goods, recalled Petra Tikal, a conservation officer, a ranger, as the program staff call themselves, whose mother comes from Hatahobe, an island about 40 miles west of the reef. It was part of a small fleet of 6 motorboats from a Chinese vessel poaching sea cucumbers that could fetch up to $800 a pound in Hong Kong. When one boat approached the ranger station on Helen Island, a sandbar on the northern edge of the reef, the team communicated through hand gestures for the illegal fishermen to return to their ship and wait for further instruction. "I was scared," Tikal said. "That was my first time encountering poachers." She slipped away and made a call by satellite phone to the program manager in Koror, Palau's largest city. Help was on the way, but it would take a couple of days to dispatch a marine law enforcement boat across the 350 miles of open ocean. The rangers, who are not permitted to board foreign vessels for their own safety, would have to stall the poachers. The fishermen later came back with rice, beer, and $20,000 cash, plus the promise of wiring an additional $30,000. Split evenly among the team, the total bribe amounted to a ranger's annual salary. The poachers had assumed their money would work, but for Hercules Emilio, the team's senior conservation officer, rejecting the money was a no-brainer. "We understand at the end of the day we're doing it for our people, for the future generation," said Emilio, who grew up on Hatahobe, who also called Toby Island, when he was young. The Chinese poachers brought their main vessel through the channel into the sheltered waters of the reef's lagoon and sent divers down to plunder. They kept offering the money and goods, but the rangers remained steadfast. Finally, with air and sea support from the U.S. Coast Guard, the patrol boat arrived from Koror on the third day and blocked the channel, trapping the Chinese vessel inside the lagoon. Officers boarded the ship and detained its crew of 28, seizing cash, motorboats, fishing gear, and 500 pounds of illegally harvested sea cucumbers. "I am so proud of our rangers," said Rosania Victor, the program's manager, in a video about the incident, "for the sacrifices they made in manning the remote station away from their families, for their bravery in intercepting an illegal fishing vessel using their experience and tactics from their trainings, and for having the integrity to refuse the bribes." Since the Helen Reef Resource Management Program launched more than 20 years ago, traditional Hatahobe stewardship has guided its safeguarding of the reef. This is a testament to conservation efforts across Palau, one of the most protected and biodiverse places in the world's oceans. Hatshari means Reef of Giant Claims, named for the once-abundant Tridactylus mollusk that, according to oral history, grew big enough for a diver to comfortably nestle inside. The atoll's lagoon channel and the extensive reef flats host a remarkable number of hard and soft coral species that provide the underwater habitat for snails, sea cucumbers, and large reef fish, such as the humphead wrasse on the island, green turtles, and thousands of seabirds build nesting sites. The intimate relationship with the Hatahobe people have with the land and sea has nurtured an enduring knowledge or a body of knowledge of practices and traditions known as Momau. These include agricultural methods, fishing techniques, and seafaring traditions that guided the original Hatahobe navigators from the distant outer islands of Yap. Hatahobe means to make stronger, magic, and find, a reminder of how the ancestors settled on the island of Hatahobe after voyaging some 800 miles by sea. Early generations of Hatahobeans raised a massive taro patch in the middle of the island to ensure a reliable food source, which they still use today. They developed an array of fishing methods, including dip net fishing by torchlight, noosing sharks, fishing under drifting logs, kite fishing, and trolling. Though many of these techniques are no longer used, knowledge of them has endured in the Hatahobe community through 2 centuries of frequent upheaval. Starting at the end of the 1800s, Palau's more than 340 islets and atolls were claimed, exploited, and ruled in succession by Spain, Germany, Japan, and following World War II, the United States. Palau gained independence in 1994 after several decades of negotiations with the U.S. Under an agreement between the two countries, Palau receives economic assistance and access to U.S. federal mail, weather, and aviation. services, and its citizens can live, work, and study in the U.S. without a visa. In exchange, the U.S. maintains military defense authority. Over the years, foreign occupations, epidemics, storms, and erosion, and extraction of natural resources have forced most of the Hadahobians to leave their home island for Karora and beyond. Of the approximately 200 people in Hadahobe ancestry Palau, only about 30 still live on the island year-round. Most reside in the community of Echang, established during the German occupation in the early 1900s in faraway Karora State. Today, Hadahobe and Hashiri remain social and cultural bedrocks for the community that continues to care for them. In the 1990s, fishing boats from Indonesia and the Philippines greedily raided the reef using dynamite, cyanide, and large nets to harvest sea cucumbers, sea snails, giant clams, sharks, groupers, and turtles. With the help of two American scientists, the community reached out to other Pacific Islanders to learn how they handled overfishing. But first it had to answer one question: who owns the reef? This prompted a series of public meetings in 1999, attended by members of all Hadahobe families. After reviewing and acknowledging family and clan oral histories, the community agreed that the reef was collectively owned by the Hadahobe people. The elder on the room asked each of the heads of family, "What is your say?" And they all voiced, "Yes," explained Wayne Andrew, a Hadahobean and senior director of the Micronesia program at the conservation nonprofit One Reef. "We want Helen Reef to be protected," he said. The approach is different from land ownership on the Hadahobe, which is clan-based, passed on matrilineally, and often contested. Such an innovative declaration of collective ownership disentangled the future of the reef from disputes and made it possible to manage for the benefit of all Hadahobeans. "Now, community is not people alone," said Andrew. "Community is a place, the reef, the respect of all that is so important." In 2000, a group of Hadahobeans and Palauans and international groups secured government and private funding to start the Helen Reef Resource Management Program. And the following year, the Hadahobe State Legislature passed a law establishing the reef as a protected area. For the first 4 years, it was closed to marine life harvest. As the reef recovered, approximately 30% of the atoll was opened up for sustainable fishing. "When we have abundance, when the spillover can supply the community," explained Thomas Petras, a former governor of Hadahobe State who was instrumental in the creation of the reserve. Eventually, the program built a permanent ranger station, trained and hired Hadahobeans and other Palauans and as conservation officers, and developed a comprehensive management plan based on scientific research and traditional knowledge. The rangers not only deter illegal fishing, but also monitor turtles and other wildlife to maintain the restoration and the health of the atoll. Petras remembered visiting the reef as a small child. "In the evening, when it's low tide, the birds come in from hunting and would fly so low that the giant clams get excited and close their shells, squirting water out." Years later, he took his kids to witness the phenomenon to no avail, but now the resources are coming back, he said, and we want to keep it that way. Traditional stewardship is about applying the knowledge that generations of Hadahobean ancestors gained while making the most of their limited resources. "They knew the right reasons for fishing," Andrew explained. "When there was a good season, they would sail out and fish for pelagic fish like mai-mai, tuna, flying fish, and needlefish. When there was a bad season with rough seas, they would fish close to the reef, rotating through different species important for their livelihoods." The people of Hadahobe use their traditional ecological knowledge in a supremely thoughtful way, agreed Stuart Sandlin, a marine biologist at the University of California, San Diego. He has led several expeditions to Hatcherie as part of the Scripps Institution of Oceanography's research initiative on reef health across the tropical Pacific. Sandlin pointed out to the area's robust populations of bumphead parrotfish and giant groupers, fish that you just don't see in heavily exploited systems. Coral regrowth is also remarkable, according to Sandlin. A series of images taken over time by his team show the reef's corals have grown back like crazy after a considerable disturbance, such as a big wave or coral bleaching event. "It's another signature that's consistent with well-managed systems," he said. Initially financed by mostly outside sources, the Howland Reef Resource Management Program is now supported largely by Palau's Protected Areas Network Fund. The independent nonprofit organization serves as financial trustee for money generated from green fees charged by the government to anyone who visits the country. This allows for the employment of 8 full-time rangers rotating in and out of Hat Sheri every 3 to 6 months. Palau's conservation measures expanded with the creation of its National Marine Sanctuary, which went into effect in 2020. One of the largest marine protected areas in the world, the refuge protects 80% of Palau's waters and more than 184,000 square miles of the Western Pacific from extractive activities, including mining and fishing. The country has some of the highest levels of marine biodiversity in all of Micronesia, with hundreds of species of hard corals, soft corals, and sponges, over 1,300 species of reef fish, and significant stocks of tuna, billfish, sharks, and rays. The fund and sanctuary share an ethos rooted in Palau's traditional practice of bowl, restricting fishing in certain reef areas in certain times of the year to allow for regeneration. Now, with the help of U.S.-based environmental organizations, Palau's current president has begun looking at ways to modify the sanctuary's boundaries to allow for increased revenue from commercial fishing, a response in part to an economic decline brought on by the COVID-19 pandemic. There is no doubt, explained Andrew, that commercial fishing in Palau would affect marine biodiversity, but any changes to the National Sanctuary's boundaries won't take away Hat Sheri's protected area status. And Andrew affirms that the people of Hatohobe will continue to look after it. A few years after the incident with the Chinese poachers, rangers still occupy the remote sandbar station. They haven't faced another international skirmish yet, but they're ready for whatever may come over the horizon. What I love about the job is that I'm helping the community, said Ranger Tickell. Even when there's another job opportunity for me, I'll stick with my island. Well, next we're going to read an article from the Voices category in this series. This is Elevating Indigenous Innovation. This is written by Deb Holland, with photographs by Ryan Redcorn. As the editors write, U.S. Secretary of the Interior Deb Holland is working to build a stronger relationship between tribal nations and the federal government, one co-stewardship agreement at a time. Now, Secretary Holland is a Pueblo of Laguna and the first Native American cabinet secretary and one of the first Native American women in Congress. Under the sun of a chilly May afternoon in 2020, I stood with members of the Confederated Salish and Kootenai Tribes, CSKT, on the Flathead Indian Reservation in Montana, part of the tribe's ancestral homelands. Tall blades of prairie grass rustled in the breeze, a nearby sign inscribed with greetings in Salish, Zesalt, and Sanka, Tisut, and Kayukit. Welcome visitors to the Bison Range. That day was a day for celebration, she writes. Several tribal members lifted their heads in unison and sang, their voices filling the air with full-throated swells and falls. Standing next to me, then CSKT Chairman Tom McDonald listened. Traditionally, he explained, his ancestors summoned the bison in song before a hunt, gesture of respect. I imagine their gratitude for Creator's gift, the living beings for the millennia provided much of what the people needed, food, clothing, shelter, tools, religious items, and a sense of belonging to their land. Of all the losses this continent has suffered, the destruction of the Great Plains is among the starkest. When the federal government began its conquest of indigenous peoples, it surmised that the Indian problem, wherein native communities lived and thrived on land sought by colonial settlers and the federal government, could be solved by destroying native food sources and livelihoods. And so men with guns killed tens of millions of bison. This set off a chain reaction of ecosystem degradation that now, intertwined with the present-day climate crisis, spelled catastrophe for ancestral homelands and the ecosystem we all depend on. For the CSKT, this loss was amplified by the federal government's unilateral withdrawal of nearly 19,000 acres at the very heart of the Flatland Reservation in 1908. Thankfully, our story doesn't end there. because bison are resilient. Indigenous peoples are still here, and indigenous innovation is enduring. The CSKT can rightfully take credit for helping save the bison from extinction. The herd that grazed those hills on the day of my visit descended from the Pablo Allard herd, one of the tribal members that began in response to the near-total destruction of the species during the 19th century. Over the decades following the 1908 land withdrawal, the CSKT persisted with a simple request to the federal government: return the land and bring the bison home. After an act of Congress in 2020 cleared a path to reverse this injustice, the Department of Interior, the federal agency I now lead, announced the transfer of the land into the tribe's ownership in June 2021. The return of the bison range to the CSKT is one of more than 200 co-stewardship agreements with tribes in the Biden-Harris administration has entered into since President Joe Biden stepped into office. Collaborative land management agreements between tribes and the federal government have emerged in recent decades to varying degrees of success, but the Biden-Harris administration is leveraging co-stewardship, shared management, and decision-making over certain lands and waters as a uniquely intentional strategy to preserve an ancestral homelands and to fulfill our trust and treaty responsibilities to tribes. I am grateful to serve in an administration that understands our country's history and seeks to remedy our past mistakes by elevating the role of tribes in the management of our public lands, waters, and wildlife. With $2 billion from President Biden's Investing in America agenda, we are advancing landscape-level conservation in partnership with the communities who care for and depend on these places every day. Successful co-stewardship ensures that indigenous knowledge, a deep understanding of the land and wildlife gained over millennia, is put to use as one of the most essential strategies to tackle the climate crisis. Implementing this knowledge can take many forms, from using traditional practices for wildfire management and ecosystem restoration to directing habitat and wildlife conservation. Above all else, this work must keep tribal voices and the expertise they bring front and center. Last October, some 2,600 miles northwest of the Bison Range, I saw this administration's commitment to co-stewardship in action yet again while visiting Alaska Native communities. On the gravel banks of the Kenai River, I watched with tears in my eyes as adult salmon, having laid their eggs, washed ashore in decay, their journeys to the sea and back again complete. That day the smell of death gripped the air, but so too did the feeling of rebirth. What I had witnessed was increasingly rare act of nature. Across Alaska, fewer and fewer salmon ever make it upriver to spawn. Each time I've had the honor to visit with Alaska Native communities as secretary, I have felt a sense of urgency as the people have described historic salmon crashes, which threaten both lifeways and the animals' relatives that are foundational to their cultures. Cultural change, among other human-made threats like habitat loss and deteriorating infrastructure, jeopardizes the salmon and Alaska Native peoples' very existence. After many meetings with department staff and Alaska Native community members, we developed the Gravel to Gravel Keystone Initiative, one of several grounded by our Restoration and Resilience Framework launched last year. The initiative will advance projects co-designed and implemented alongside tribes, including the restoration of degraded streams, expansion of habitat assessments, and replenishment of native vegetation throughout Alaska's Yukon, Kuskokwim, and Norton Sound region, nearly 420,000 square miles. To progress as a nation, we must heal our wounds with the love and guidance of those who were wounded. During the bison range that day, I observed those powerful animals up close, their winter coats sloughing off thick patches of knotted fur and giving way to smooth, mottled, dark skin. As the bison claimed their rightful place on the landscape, I prayed and thanked the ancestors who had protected them when times were the hardest. At the turn of the 20th century, settlers, pioneers, and the federal government failed to recognize what indigenous peoples have always known, that our understanding of and devotion to the land remains constant. Indigenous knowledge is indigenous innovation, and the ancestors were the first innovators. If we're to save ourselves, we must empower this knowledge with everything we have. And that is written, of course, by Interior Secretary Deb Haaland. Well, again, the article, as we said, written by her, and we will have more articles from the May 2024 special issue of National Geographic to be covered in future episodes of Armchair Traveler, okay? So, to close out today's episode of Armchair Traveler, we're going to read an excerpt from an article written by Lauren Onsurge that reveals how Hawaii is a top destination for travelers flying out of Raleigh-Durham International Airport. Her article appeared in the January 16, 2024 issue of Triangle Business Journal. So let's see what she's learned, okay? And it comes with an interesting photo of Honolulu, Hawaii, top destination for travelers flying out of RDU, it says. And then the headline reads, "The Most Popular and In-Demand Destinations at RDU." And again, this was updated in January of 2024. "For in-demand routes, passengers keep coming, even without nonstop flights out of Raleigh-Durham International Airport. Numbers released by RDU show that the most popular destinations are those with nonstop connections and multiple carriers. Orlando, served by Delta Airlines, Frontier, JetBlue, Southwest Airlines, and Spirit Airlines tops the list, with more than 805 passengers per day traveling between the Florida City and RDU. But picking through the list shows several domestic destinations that are not currently served by an RDU airline, meaning potential opportunities for carriers looking to expand their networks in 2024. And they have a gallery here of the most popular routes at RDU without a nonstop flight, and this is based on daily passenger numbers. There are 10 destinations: San Jose, California; Albany, and that Albany has a picture of the New York State Capitol building with it. Then there's Milwaukee with a picture of the Milwaukee Art Museum at night. Next is Laguna Beach in Orange County in Southern California. Then we have urban Honolulu, Hawaii, followed by Sacramento, and that has a picture of a drone above Sacramento. Memphis, the picture of a skyline with river and boats, and these routes popular with RDU travelers, according to the writer, even though as of January there are no current nonstop flights offered by the airlines." That's interesting. Some of that is changing, by the way, since this article was written. "And more than half of the 10 in-demand unserved domestic routes are out of RDU or to the West Coast, San Diego topping the list. That, too, will change as Breeze Airways says it will launch an RDU San Diego service in April. And of the 10 unserved routes with in-demand West Coast destinations, San Diego, Portland, Sacramento, Honolulu, Orange County, California, and San Jose. And that varies in passengers per day from 55 passengers a day to about 170 passengers per day. So it shows you how busy things are. The most popular routes as far as daily passenger numbers goes: Tampa, Fort Lauderdale, O'Hare International at Chicago, Denver Skyline, JFK in New York, Newark, and Atlanta. And that, my friends, brings us to the end of today's journey on Armchair Traveler. I hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be with us again next week when we have another episode. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and I remind you that the content of our program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. By the way, Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. Comments and questions can be directed to 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.